Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This summer, a 20-year-old man pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in the death of a 15-year-old girl from Roseville. While murder convictions aren't rare, this specific case caught the attention of other prosecutors around California because it is believed to be the first in the state in which a fentanyl dealer was convicted of murder. In recent years, fentanyl deaths have skyrocketed. The drug is 50 times stronger than heroin and 100 times stronger than morphine. Increasingly, it is unknowingly laced into counterfeit prescription pills like Xanax or Percocet, for example, which is why public health officials warn one pill can kill. But prosecuting these cases have been difficult, given the harmful impacts of the war on drugs in the 80s and 90s, which greatly impacted neighborhoods of color seen to this day, and an evolving approach to distinguish the public health crisis of mental health and addiction. That debate has been emotional and fraught at the state capitol as lawmakers navigate the best way to curb this epidemic. I sat down with Placer County's district attorney, Morgan Geyer, to discuss what motivated him to seek and secure the first murder conviction of a fentanyl death in the state. He also urged the need to strike a balance between public health and safety to turn the tide in the fentanyl crisis. District Attorney Geyer, thank you for making the time.
Thank you very much for having me. My pleasure.
You made the fentanyl crisis a top priority when you took office back in 2020. Why was this issue specifically so important to you?
Lots of factors. We were thrust into the crisis in 2020. We were in the middle of a global pandemic. The world was shut down. And our county, not unique to other communities, was seeing an alarming rate of particularly teenagers and young adults dying from fentanyl. They were probably engaging in risk-taking behavior more than they were probably prone to, given the circumstances of the pandemic. We had seniors in high school missing life-defining moments, people who were already prone to depression because of isolation and things like that were exacerbated. And we, as a team, just sort of realized we had to do more.
We've had this conversation on Insight multiple times over the last couple of years, and unfortunately, it's just continued to grow and evolve in the wrong direction in California. I remember in 2021 talking to parents who lost a child from fentanyl poisoning, and they do emphasize poisoning because these counterfeit pills are unknowingly laced with fentanyl. Can you explain for listeners that distinction between overdosing and poisoning?
Absolutely. And that was a steep learning curve for me during this fentanyl crisis. And it began with what became sort of a high profile case in our community. It was a high school senior named Zach Didier who had died from fentanyl poisoning. And it was in my discussions with his family as we were reviewing the case. We sadly had other cases we were reviewing to figure out this ultimate question of how and should you hold someone responsible for selling something that is dangerous to someone else. And in this discussion, these parents who had never really heard of what fentanyl was before until the coroner told them that was the cause of their son's death had said he was poisoned. And we sort of had this very marked discussion about it. And it was very enlightening to me. And it was illustrating that there are two separate fronts of this fentanyl crisis that we are fighting. There are those who are battling addiction, those who are seeking fentanyl. And unfortunately, with the lethality of the fentanyl that's in today's market, we are losing those people more rapidly. Usually drug addiction, if it goes untreated, will cost you your life, but after a long, prolonged battle. This aspect of fentanyl, the poisoning aspect of it, was completely different. These were people who were being deceived, and they took something that they thought was something else. And the sort of example that I have used, because I heard from some of these parents, were if I walked into a bar and ordered a shot of whiskey, and someone poured me a shot of cyanide and I drank it, no one would say I overdosed on cyanide. They would say you were poisoned. You took something that you thought was something else. You were deceived, and it cost you your life. And it became clear that there's a difference. And there's also, I think, a social difference a little bit in how we describe the problem. And part of that, and it's a difficult line to draw because there is some shame involved in the taking of those substances because it's something somebody shouldn't have done. And so calling it an overdose sort of has societal implications. Not that those are not worthy of treating, not that those aren't worthy of fighting, but it's a different situation. And I think the way we try and proactively fight this fight, we need to be precise with our vocabulary. And that was very, very informative to me to have that conversation.
And in that time, fentanyl deaths have skyrocketed across the state. In Placer County, data from the county shows a 450% increase in fentanyl deaths between 2019 and 2021. One piece of responding to this is criminal justice and holding those responsible accountable. What are the challenges and kind of the nuances with achieving that goal when it comes specifically to fentanyl?
Yeah, and I appreciate the intro there. It is one piece of an overall campaign in this fentanyl crisis. It is critically important. This fentanyl crisis is not, it's not just a public health issue, and it's not just a public safety or criminal justice issue. It's a combination of all of those things. So when it comes to the criminal justice aspect, it hadn't been done before. The idea that we're punishing drug dealers for selling drugs that are ultimately harmful, that's been done forever, and we have debated how best to handle those who are selling drugs. But fentanyl changed the landscape. Its accessibility, its lethality, the deception around it was costing lives right and left. And so this question became, how do we appropriately identify those who need to be held accountable versus those who might be in need of treatment because they themselves are addicts? And it's a very fine line on how we draw that distinction. But what we do is we are guided by the evidence of any particular investigation. Is someone's motive for selling profit? And if it is motivated by profit, are they aware of the risks? And how can we determine and ultimately demonstrate to a jury, if we choose to charge, what the evidence is that separates someone who is motivated by this deadly profit as opposed to someone who is struggling to feed their own addiction? And it's incumbent upon prosecutors to identify those differences. But that's sort of the hallmarks of determining whether or not someone is deserving of criminal prosecution, and then if they are, whether or not that ultimately results in a murder charge or something legally less than that.
The reason why we're talking to you is because your office secured a second-degree murder conviction of a fentanyl dealer. That is the first of its kind in California. Given that fentanyl is a crisis that spans and transcends California across the country, in this state specifically, why is this conviction so rare? Why is Placer County the first?
We have a limited amount of criminal liability statutes that can hold someone accountable for the act of selling something that ends up being deadly. So we have, on the low end of causing someone's death, we have involuntary manslaughter, which is punished not real significantly. And under California law, someone who causes the death of someone else through recklessness or negligence, you have that on the one sort of side of the spectrum. And on the other end, we have murder, which obviously is the most extreme punishment that we can ask for in criminal law as it relates to the death of someone. The real question for prosecutors is, and I teach courses to law enforcement and to students, and I always say when it comes to being a prosecutor, there's the debate of can you do something, and then there's the more complicated debate of should you do something. And that's why I think, given the number of deaths we've had in our county, we've seen a very small percentage of those investigations result in the filing of criminal charges. And that's because either we can't prove it, or in those situations that we can, the question, should we, is answered in the negative.
The case that resulted in this conviction involved the fentanyl death of a 15-year-old girl from Roseville. The man who was convicted is 20-year-old Nathaniel Kabakungun. Can you tell us more about this case and what stood out to you about this case?
So I will speak somewhat generally. The case is still pending sentencing. So following the sentencing, I can speak a little more freely about
that. That's later this month, correct?
It is, yes. It's set for the 16th of this month. But generally, in these kinds of cases, what we look for is sort of what I mentioned earlier, is are there those hallmarks of knowledge about the danger of what the substance is? Is there that sort of profit motivation? Is there what we refer to as sort of a deadly ambivalence, that appreciation of a risk and a disregarding of that risk, saying, I don't care. I know what I'm doing is dangerous and deadly, but I'm going to engage in this behavior anyway. And when we can answer those questions as a yes, it clearly moves the needle towards some sort of criminal prosecution, and in these cases, murder, when the evidence that underlies someone's knowledge of how dangerous their behavior is overwhelming and can obviously be proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
You mentioned Zachary Didier, and that was a 17-year-old Rockland teen who died in 2020 due to fentanyl poisoning. In the courtroom for this second-degree murder conviction was his parents. And in his case specifically, that suspect pled guilty in 2022, sentenced to 17 years for involuntary manslaughter in addition to other charges. How did this case lay the framework for this second-degree murder conviction?
The Bordner case, the case in which Zach Didier was killed, was our first one. It was the first one in our county. It was one of the relatively first ones to be in the COVID era of a fentanyl poisoning. And we had to navigate by looking around throughout the state of how other offices were handling it. We obviously know our theories of liability and we know what our options were. But nothing really had reached the goal line yet on the murder aspect of it. So we were going through the investigation to try and determine how do we hold the person, should we hold this person responsible, and if so, how. Clearly, the selling of deadly fentanyl to someone is at a very minimum negligent, reckless, and is the basis for an involuntary manslaughter charge. But as we were making our way through Zach's case, we kept having more and more teenagers and young adults dying. And unfortunately, they all usually typically start as a coroner case where there's a medical emergency. And it's not seen as a crime scene. It's not seen necessarily as something that might lead to criminal punishment when someone has a medical emergency that requires first responders to come in and either transport them or attempt CPR. So our ability to gauge and analyze these investigations sadly got better through it happening more and more.
Now, since your conviction in July, there are two other Northern California district attorneys who have filed murder charges in fentanyl deaths. One is in Sutter County, and the other, which was just filed this week, it was by Sacramento County District Attorney Tian Ho, who you worked with during your 15 years in the Sacramento County DA's office. Is there collaboration or even communication among district attorneys since you all are grappling with the same crisis?
There are, and fortunately, the especially the Northern California district attorneys communicate frequently. We have sort of regional meetings. This has been the one of the most significant issues affecting our offices for the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. So most have already done the analysis of whether or not they would be willing, under the right circumstances, to file these kinds of cases, and really just waiting for those facts to present themselves. Not waiting as in, I can't wait and I'm hoping, but with that dread of, at some point, we're going to find an investigation with a set of facts that are going to deserve, in our opinion, the filing of murder charges. So we're all familiar with the law. It's really just a sharing of investigative tactics because these are relatively new investigations. And how do you piece together the final moments of someone's life as they interact with the individual who sold them the deadly fentanyl? So we trade tactics and tips in that respect. But I think the fundamental question of whether or not murder charges should be filed in these circumstances ultimately rests with the discretion of the elected DA of that particular county. And you've seen those that are willing to do so. And you may see more in the future, or you may hear from some that say, I don't think this is ever appropriate.
And your office currently has filed other murder charges against other suspected fentanyl dealers, correct?
We have, yes. We have two others currently pending.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we've been speaking with Placer County District Attorney Morgan Geyer, who secured the first murder conviction against a fentanyl dealer in California. Earlier this year, the California legislature, they debated how to address the fentanyl crisis, and that led to emotional testimony during committee hearings. The central debate among lawmakers, and really I think the general public as well, was whether to combat this crisis through public safety and tougher punishments or focus more on education and prevention. What stands out to you about this debate?
What stands out remarkably is that I think our legislature did a very good job in responding to the public health aspect of the fentanyl crisis. And I was a little, frankly, disappointed in the response and their actions as it relates to public safety. This is not a unilateral situation that requires only a certain kind of approach. We need all tools available. I am very cognizant of the concern and fear about sort of reinvigorating the failed war on drugs. And that is oftentimes what is said in response to prosecutors who are seeking to be aggressive to those who are selling deadly fentanyl. But we need to be able to attack both the education, outreach, and prevention side to reduce demand. But we also need to be able to aggressively hold people accountable who know exactly what they're doing. And that falls on the district attorney to be able to do that. And we need flexibility and a number of different tools so that our only option isn't a murder charge when we wouldn't want one to be there. Mm.
When it comes to the war on drugs, you know, opponents who, you know, don't want harsher penalties for the fentanyl cases, you know, they argue that during the country's crack epidemic, it inevitably created harmful consequences for underserved communities, communities of colors, and these communities that still can be felt very much today. What is your response to those concerns, especially when striking the right balance, as you're talking about, striking that right balance between public safety with prevention and treatment?
It's an excellent question, and I would start off by pointing out that the victims of this fentanyl crisis are overwhelmingly people of color and disadvantaged communities, and they are being ravaged by this illicit and deadly fentanyl. Striking that balance is key, and there were a lot of lessons learned, I think, from what we consider the war on drugs from the 80s and 90s that were had very punitive measures towards people who were battling addiction, people who were perhaps selling to feed that addiction. And I think fentanyl, while the profit motivation for selling drugs hasn't changed, that's the same motivation that has been present as long as we've been living together as a society. This is different. Fentanyl has changed the landscape. The lethality of it is unbelievable. And we are starting to become aware of that intimately. Everyone is starting to aware. You can't become aware. You can't travel around our communities in Sacramento County, Placer County, all of our surrounding counties without seeing warnings, without seeing billboards, without having heard of these stories. And the idea that someone can take a small amount of this and die on their first occasion, and a dealer very well may know that, is what sort of lends to the idea that we need to be holding dealers more accountable. But finding that balance is absolutely critical. Unfortunately, well, I say fortunately, district attorneys are charged with that amount of discretion, and there's no way to craft a law that prevents us from exercising discretion and having any sort of ability to hold someone accountable. Because whether we like it or not, there are those who know exactly what they're doing, and they're poisoning people, and they're making a profit on it, and that's more important than the health and safety of their customers.
Given that you've been dissatisfied with the public safety aspect of legislation that's making its way through the Capitol, which would, you know, I think in your view, make your job easier and other district attorneys' jobs easier when it comes to having penalties against fentanyl dealers, you know, is what you're doing now by securing the first murder conviction in California when it came to a fentanyl death, is this kind of finding a way around legislation as these bills are kind of in limbo and they're moving through the state capitol?
I would never file a murder charge simply because I don't have any other alternative. The facts and circumstances of a case justify a murder charge or they don't. I would like some other flexibility because while those cases are going to be rare and represent a very small number, there are other situations where a murder charge would not be appropriate, but my ability to hold someone accountable may be not enough, frankly. And there, we don't have a lot of flexibility on that aspect. There are dealers of all different varieties and up and down the food chain in this hierarchy of drug dealers. There are high quantity dealers who are selling hundreds or thousands of pills at a time that could be lethal to an entire community. There are those street level dealers who are selling 5 to 10 pills at a time. Those are the ones that we see killing people in our community more often because that's the direct interface that our users have or our victims that are purchasing these. So I would like to see a little bit more flexibility and just a few more tools in our toolbox, so to speak, to be able to hold those dealers accountable. But again, the murder charges are going to be there based on their own merits and not simply because, well, everything else is too lenient. Therefore, I'm going to charge something for murder that otherwise wouldn't independently. We're not going to be doing that, and I trust no other district attorney would feel that way either. But there is room to have more flexibility in our criminal law.
Finally, you're born and raised in Placer County, and now you're the Placer County District Attorney. You have been for the last couple of years. What makes you optimistic that, you know, we're at, or hopefully soon, at a turning point in this crisis?
While the focus of most of my conversations lately have been on the criminal justice aspect of it, my hope comes from our outreach efforts. Placer County, like we discussed, we had tackled that early on. We had reached every high school student by last year. Every high school student had attended an assembly. We had talked to parents. We've had conversations in the community about signs, sort of new signs, not just automatic self-isolation or failing school, the classic hallmark signs of a kid who is struggling. But we've seen kids who are straight-A students who are dying of fentanyl. And that has caused families to have conversations that they otherwise wouldn't have had about how are you feeling and what sort of pressures are you under. And through those conversations, I know that we're saving lives. It's always hard to calculate how many lives you've saved through this, but through the conversations our communities are having throughout our region, I know that it's having an impact. The numbers, at least for 2023 that we've seen, tend to show that the youth, the teenagers and young adults, those numbers are reducing. We will still have those who are dying from fentanyl of all ages, but it seems to be the average age seems to be trending upward, which means those outreach efforts are hopefully finding their target audience, which is the teenagers and young adults. So I'm optimistic that through those efforts, combined with our public safety efforts, we're making a difference in saving lives.
District Attorney Geyer, thank you for the time.
Thank you so much for having this conversation with me. I really appreciate it.
That is Placer County District Attorney Morgan Geyer discussing what motivated his office to secure the first murder conviction of a fentanyl dealer in California. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.